This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My first guest this week is Nick Kroll. He's a comedian, actor, and writer. He starred on the FX show The League for years. He created the sketch comedy series Kroll Show. If you watched VH1 in the early 2000s, you probably saw him making jokes about pop culture on Best Week Ever. Nick also created the Broadway show Oh Hello, where he and John Mulaney play Gil Faison and George St. Gigland, two men who embody a very specific kind of New Yorker, the kind you might find in a cotton baseball cap and ill-fitting khakis, frowning at a folded-up copy of the New York Times. Or maybe, if we're being less generous, the kind who might be going through coat pockets at a house party or hosting a $900 acting seminar despite not really being an actor. The inspiration was two real guys in a bookstore who were arguing about Alan Alda's autobiography.
Who are we really? You know, what is our essence? How to describe?
You know when you get to the bottom of a tub of hummus? And you can't fit your carrot in there, so you gotta use your fingies to scoop it out. Bam, that's us, baby!
Lately, Nick Kroll has been focused more on the world of animation. In 2017, he co-created the show Big Mouth, which is on Netflix. It's a hit comedy that's basically about puberty. There's a group of teens in upstate New York. They're really going through it. There are hormone monsters. They're the ones who cause puberty. Then friends and family who have to live with pubescent teens. It's a little bit like Inside Out. If Nick Kroll made Inside Out.
Oh, hey, Olivia. You want to get a drink or something? I think they have LaCroix. It's only the coconut kind, which is a little gross, but it's still kind of...
No, sorry, Dylan.
Oh, who? I thought we were going to this dance, like, together.
No.
Sorry, bro. She wants a real man. Ninth grade. Top of the food chain.
Last year, I talked with Nick about his new show in the same universe as Big Mouth. It's called Human Resources. That show is about the same monsters and their workplace, along with the adult feelings that they represent. The show just released its second season on Netflix. It features the voice talents of folks like Aidy Bryant, Rosie Perez, Thandi Newton, Maria Bamford, and many, many others. And Human Resources, like Big Mouth, is very, very weird and more than a little bit crass.
Guys, break room for birthday cake.
Shh, he's coming.
Come on, Maury. The meeting I told you about, which is very real, is happening here in the break room.
I don't know why we'd be having a meeting in the break room, but I do believe you.
Happy birthday to you.
I don't want a birthday cake.
But Maury, it's a cookie cake, not a regular cake. It's cookie cake. I'll explain. It's basically cookies just mushied into a cake shape.
Tyler, if you say the words cookie or cake one more time, I'll mushy you into a dead shape. Ugh.
Maury, what the hell?
You think that's going to stop me from eating cookie cake?
Nick Kroll, welcome back to Bullseye. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well.
I see that you've expanded your empire of our most disgusting and horrible feelings and bodily functions beyond puberty here. You're like,
yeah, it's a, yeah, my empire of dirt, I guess we could call it. Yes. To quote Nine Inch Nails, I don't know if that is the line. Is it?
Yeah.
That song? I don't know. I know weirdly the Johnny Cash version of it better than I know the, anyway. Yes, I am. There's so many more disgusting emotions for us to explore that felt necessary to do so.
Well, you keep expanding the palette of Big Mouth with like new characters and new sort of big subjects of horrible adolescent discomfort. And just at a certain point, you're like, oh, let's get involved in adult shame here.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, we, you know, in Big Mouth, it was, it's always been through the lens of puberty, and each season just about there's a new character or a creature that is anthropomorphizing, whether it's the Shame Wizard in season two or Tito the Anxiety Mosquito in season, I think in season four. And in season five of Big Mouth, we introduce Love Bugs and Hate Worms, which are two heads of the same coin. And in doing so, in addition to the other, you know, the hormone monsters have been there since the beginning, we realized at the end of season two, we did this episode where the kids go up into the what we call where the hormone monsters work, and we see their workplace, and that's where we got a glimpse at the ambition gremlins and DNA apes and all these other characters. And as we continued to develop the show, I think we realized that that world was super rich. And as we build stories for Big Mouth, and it's, you know, it's a show about kids going through puberty, and unless the story really has a focus on adolescence or puberty, there are great stories that we've wanted to tell, or stories that are interesting to us that we wanted to tell that just didn't fit inside of that space. So we created Human Resources, which is in the workplace of the monsters and creatures, and it allows us to talk about all the other, the myriad of human experiences, and tell a lot of different kinds of stories that you just can't tell through the lens of 13-year-old kids going through puberty.
Did you already talk to other people about the discomforts of puberty before you started making Big Mouth?
I'm trying to think. You know, I think when my partners, Andrew Goldberg and Mark Levin and Jen Flackett, they approached me with this idea. Andrew Goldberg and I have been friends since childhood, and they approached me with a show about kids going through puberty, and specifically Andrew and I's experience in that. It felt immediately like, oh, yep, that this makes sense. I mean, I had done, the first thing I ever did was a book called Bar Mitzvah Disco with Roger Bennett and Jules Schell. I think I may have spoken to you about that many years ago.
I interviewed about you on that show, and I had forgotten completely until this second. Yeah. But I think I interviewed you about that on my college radio show.
I believe so. And so that was, you know, that was the first thing I kind of did, almost that official like thing that got made. So I've been sort of looking at that period of time of adolescence and the awkwardness of that time, I guess the majority of my professional career. And that time was, I think, as for all of us, very formative. It's foundational going through puberty, and we carry so much of what happened to us in that period of time to the rest of our lives. So it became incredibly important to me. It was a very important time in the formation of who I am. And yet now doing Human Resources, there are just, I mean, it's just like the first episode is about a woman giving birth. And not immediately falling in love with her child. Our co-creator, so it's me and Andrew and Mark and Jen, and then we brought Kelly Galuska, who's one of the senior writers on Big Mouth, in to write the show, and she just had a baby. She didn't have the feeling of our character in the show of not, but it's not an uncommon thing to, you have this baby and then it's thrust on you, and whether you're the mother or the father, it's like, it's assumed that you're going to be madly in love with this child that you've never laid eyes on before. Oftentimes you are, but oftentimes there's a lot of other factors that go into birth that make it hard to immediately be like, oh my God, I've never loved anything more. And so it felt like an interesting experience to be the first episode of what that experience is. Now, the other difference between Human Resources and Big Mouth is our Big Mouth is always told from the perspective of the kids, and then these creatures come in as adding perspective for the kids. Our show, Human Resources, is now really told from the perspective of the creatures, and the humans are supporting the stories of whatever the creatures are going through. And so in this first episode, you have Emmy, who's a love bug voiced by A.D. Bryant, and Emmy is being promoted. So it's like, it's really a story about someone who's got a job, who's going basically transitioning from an assistant to a non-assistant role. And it's about her learning how to be better at her job. And then we use this story of a woman giving birth and what's it like for Love Bug to try to convince this person you need to love this child right away.
The question, Nick, was, did you actually talk to other people about the horrors of adolescence before it was your job?
Thank you for keeping me on message. I did. I talked to a lot of people. We talked about it in the room, obviously, with other writers. We talked about it with kids. We've had a number of, at the time, now it feels weird saying Skypes, now that we live in a post-Skype Zoom world, but we would Skype with this woman, sex education expert, Shafia Zaloom, up in the Bay Area, and her students, and we would talk to them about stuff around puberty and adolescence, as opposed to just like nostalgically looking back, like you and I, or with other writers. It was important.
I have a lot of fond nostalgia for,
yeah, sure,
wondering why there were lumps in my breasts.
Yeah,
that happened to me.
In your nipples or in your breasts?
Like in my nipples. Yeah, yeah.
I had my eyes out. My mom told me that was a secondary sex characteristic, and I was a late bloomer, and so I was looking for the boys with engorged nipples, because I was like, they're going through puberty, and I was like waiting for my nipples to be knotted.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
Do I have cancer? I thought to myself, and I had full your body's changing education. Just never mentioned that one.
No, it's a weird one. They don't really throw out there to you.
So much more to get into with Nick Kroll. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, from Onyx Collective and Hulu. Directed by Prentice Penny, executive producer of Insecure, Black Twitter, A People's History, tells the story of how Black voices found a new home online and blossomed into a force for change while laying down some hilarious tweets along the way. From the memes to the movements, see how this powerful community shapes culture, society, and politics. Black Twitter, A People's History, is now streaming on Hulu.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear, it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us now, I am talking with Nick Kroll. He's an actor and a comedian. He created the sketch comedy series Kroll Show on Comedy Central. He and his friend John Mulaney also created the Broadway show Oh Hello. Lately, Kroll has been doing a lot of animation work. He co-created the show Big Mouth on Netflix, which is about puberty and the literalized monsters who cause it. And he also created a spinoff of that show called Human Resources. That just released its second season on Netflix. So the first time I interviewed you was 20 years ago, apparently.
Yeah.
And
2005, I think we put the book out.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And in that time, I have seen the kinds of comedy that you have done change a lot. You know, you rose to prominence doing like big, broad characters, mm-hmm, with silly voices, mm-hmm, that were often like a guy you saw on the subway, mm-hmm, who and heard him say a sentence and thought like, well, what if I talked in that funny voice?
Yes.
They were very far from you. They were not always dudes. They, mm-hmm, you were often performing transracially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was the biggest, furthest things from you could get a hold of,
mm-hmm,
and making them insane.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Big Mouth is a change from that,
mm-hmm,
but it's still very retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
And in Human Resources, you actually maybe have to engage with the person that you are.
Yeah, sure.
Is that a little scary?
I've had a lot of practice now working on Big Mouth, and then now doing a lot more stand-up. I've been I'm really inspired by the more autobiographical elements of Big Mouth, and to learn to be more personally vulnerable and personally self revealing, that my stand-up has started to reflect that more than when you started interviewing me, and I was much more comfortable on stage. I mean, I think I had access to being on stage more than I then had access to being making videos and then making like Kroll Show broad characters, which I loved playing. And I don't know. I want to say that it was more, it's a personal evolution versus the realities of culture shifting, where there are many characters that I would do 10 years ago that I would never do today. That I think, you know, for many reasons. And I think as culture evolves and where we are with comedy right now, I think more of that has been like, as you're saying, it's more been a reflection of me being like, it was scary to reveal myself for many years. And it was fun to do these characters, but over time it's been like, no, I think ultimately I got to start talking about myself and my experience and try to find what's interesting about that. And it happens to have coincided with a thing where it's more complicated for me as like a straight cis hetero white male to play characters that are very far away from what my experience has been. Animation has been a beautiful transitional place for me to do that, because Big Mouth is loosely autobiographical, and then the characters that I play around that are characters that I can sort of jump into and that are not myself, but some extension of myself in some way. And so that's been a wonderful way to do that. You know, I think it's a personal evolution. I don't know how many comedians work this way or not, but I definitely think it's been very rewarding and valuable for me personally, just in my own, let's call it artistic journey, to to be like, oh, I guess I should explore myself and not just in, hopefully not in a narcissistic way, but in like a way that's like, oh, if I'm going to be able to play this character that's completely different than me, I should be able to talk and make fun of myself in the same way.
Do you think you were worried about how people would receive you when you started?
No, I think it's a little, at least for me, was always safer to be like, this person that I have a broad sketch of that I saw on the subway or that I listened to on the radio or that I like dealt with at a, you know, in a publicity like junket, it was easier to be like, oh well this, like, you know, like what was publicity Liz then becomes Lola. It's like, oh, this woman who like sips her smoothies out of a big sippy cup and like, you know, has a partner that whatever. It's like I can draw a very quick and broad sketch about that person and have a quick beat on what I think their perspective on the world is. When it came to myself, it was like, well, I don't know what my perspective on the world is, because I know every single element to my own personality to make it harder to boil that personality down to a digestible like thumbnail or soundbite like it is when you're playing a broad character. And then there's also just the feeling of like the fear of revealing your vulnerabilities and like, what is that? You know, it's a, at least for me, I mean, I think everyone's different. I think but there are plenty of stand-ups who are like, no, I have my perspective on the world. That's what I want to share with the world. For me, I was like, I don't think I know if I care about my perspective. I don't know if people will care about my perspective, or I've wanted to keep that private. I've wanted to keep myself separate. I wanted to keep like a distance between Nick Kroll, the human being, and Nick Kroll, the artist. And I don't want to let the public, an audience, into my personal, it's protective.
I mean, I think that I think especially in stand-up, which you've done tons of, both including and not including character work, there is this thing that you know, if you're going to play clubs especially, you have to kind of identify who you are and what kind of thing you are going to be presenting within 10 seconds of getting on stage. The classic, I know what you're thinking, so-and-so and such had a baby opening line, right?
Yeah.
You need to give the audience a context for them to receive you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when your identity categories include straight, white dude, you're Jewish, but, you know, Judaism, a category of whiteness in the United States.
Sure.
So straight, white dude, affluent background, like you're walking on stage with something that is indistinctive, unless you're going to do rich guy jokes, indistinctive to the audience, and also like completely, you know, completely hegemonic. So like something that people are, if anything, going to resent a little. You know what I mean?
Well,
and so I think a lot of people who are in that position get really good at doing something that is either universal or something that is abstract. Because it's hard for them to figure out how to put over their own specifics, because maybe they don't even, because they're not so different, they don't think of their own difference. Because they're not so different from power, they don't think of their own difference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was thinking, for sure was not thinking about that when I started. And I think it's only in the last few years that, like, the indistinguishableness of, like, white, straight, male vibes, like, no straight white men were thinking about that in comedy even five years ago, of being like, wait, I am indistinguishable, and that is not a win for me. Like, I just don't think nobody was thinking about that. It was, you know, I think I was protecting a little bit of, like, coming from privilege. For sure, I was not like, let me focus on this, except, you know, on Kroll shows, like, there's one of the main tent poles was like, rich dicks, you know what I mean? I was like, I'm not hiding. Watch one interview and I'll tell you where I came from. You know what I mean? But I also was like, I don't think that's terribly relatable. So my stand-up now has become, more of like, here's, you know, I'm like interested in birth order. Like, where do you fall in your birth order? I think that's, I had that experience. Everyone has experience, whether you're straight or trans or Mexican or Jewish or, you know, Persian. It doesn't matter. Everybody has birth order. Everybody's dealing with that. Here's my way into that. I hope you can join me in that journey. I had a child. Here's my way into that. Like, you were a child, you're having a child, or you're dating someone. Like, I had my heart broken. Like, all that stuff. Like, I think that's the key as artists, is like, how do we find our way in to that is specifically our experience, but hopefully in our specificity that I'm finding some universality for people to attach their experience to connect to what I'm saying.
Yeah, I was thinking of John Mulaney, with whom you've worked for decades. And the first time I saw Mulaney was in New York at a club called Comics.
Sure.
Doesn't exist anymore. With an X.
Funny.
In the Meatpacking District, which booked a lot of great comics for being a club called Comics with an X in the Meatpacking District. And maybe why they're not open anymore. But I saw Mulaney do a headlining set, and it was some of the best jokes I had ever seen in my life. He was 24 years old or 25 years old. Some of the best jokes I'd ever seen in my life, and perhaps the most abstract stand-up comedy set I'd ever seen. Like, truly just doing jokes. Not like in the sense of, you know, not like Stephen Wright, not like jokes in that form, but like, here's some big, diffuse ideas with some really perfect specifics and really, like, not about him particularly at all. And, you know, if you watch a special that he put out 3-4 years ago, it is the same perfect jokes, but it's very much about him.
Yeah.
And, you know, very much about who he is in the world, which, you know, takes some time to get to.
Yeah. Some people are great at it right off the bat. Some people, and I don't know if everyone ends up there, but I think people are, and I don't know if it's a function of how culture works now, of whether, you know, with podcasts, with, there's so many forms of personal revelation for people, but I think audiences do crave that intimacy. And I think artists are trying to figure out how to, like, bring intimacy and relevance to what they're saying. And I think that oftentimes comes with very personalized material in a way that, you know, and I don't know if that's like the natural evolution of a stand-up or an artist, comedian, or if it's just like, or if that's just like where we are going generally culturally or not. I don't know.
We'll wrap up with Nick Kroll after a quick break. Back in a minute. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, which believes plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull landscapes into colorful, vital spaces for work and play. Available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide. Or learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
What is up, people of the world? Do you have an argument that you keep having with your friends and you just can't seem to settle it? And you're sitting there arguing about whether it's Star Trek or Star Wars, or you can't decide what is the best nut, or can't agree on what is the best cheese?
Stop doing that. Listen to We Got This with Mark and Hal, only on Max Fun.
Your topics asked and answered objectively, definitively, for all time.
So don't worry, everybody. We got this.
We got this.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Nick Kroll. He's a comic and the co-creator of the Netflix animated shows Big Mouth and Human Resources. Do you think that the fact that you grew up with a dad who, you know, founded a private intelligence firm that became a huge, huge thing that eventually sold for $1 point something billion mm-hmm. or something, made you hyper aware of the relationship between the like public narrative of your life and the private narrative of your life and the artistic narrative of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I grew up, I think because my dad did something very specific that wasn't like he's a lawyer or he's in finance or like, or a doctor. Like I grew up in a, you know, affluent upper middle class area. But even from the beginning, my dad always did something that was interesting and different. It was like, you know, I would say like my dad is a private investigator. He doesn't wear a trench coat. He doesn't carry a gun. Like what everyone thought of as a PI.
He's more of an Encyclopedia Brown type.
Yeah. And so I was slightly aware he was known in certain circles. And so I understood that there was like, it wasn't famous like someone who's like, you know, like Kate Hudson being like, you know, Goldie Hawn being her mother. It wasn't like that at all. But there was, it wasn't just like, oh, he's a standard upper middle class businessman. Nor did that when he sold, you know, I was an adult when he sold the company. I think I was very conscious of, I was conscious of like being from, you know, having a parent or both my parents were like in our community well known. So I was aware of that. And I was aware of that, like there's things that are public and things that are private, that you can be known in the community. And then you also have your like the way your family works and the way that things that are discussed in the house that aren't discussed out in the world. And we all have that on various levels, maybe not because of some specificity to like your parents' occupation. So I was aware of that. And I think early on, there was a lot of me being protective of myself and where I came from because I was either trying to not be caught up in like the narrative of who my family was or who my dad was or is. And also, and I still have that. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and wanting to be like, well, I made this on my own. You know what I mean? Of course I benefit from the privilege of my family and the benefits that I had of being like, I'm going to do comedy. And if it doesn't work, I'll be okay. That's a massive benefit, which I'm well aware of. But I also think like, you know, that doesn't mean that I was then like, if I couldn't make a group of people in a room laugh, then I wasn't going to be a comedian, you know? But I found myself protective of whether protective of it because I felt my family and my background felt private to me, or because I was like, this is completely unrelatable to 99% of the people of my audience. Like, this is not going to be relatable for me to talk about my experience.
What was something that happened in your family that was like a private narrative and not a public narrative?
That you want me to now share publicly?
If there's something, I was about to add, if there's something that you would feel comfortable sharing with the benefit of time.
I mean, the truth is, there was very limited amount talked about of what my father did professionally because it was built around
discretion.
Yeah. So it was like he was hired to investigate. The Kuwaiti government hired him to investigate where Saddam Hussein was hiding his money during the first Gulf War. I was like 13. And I was 13, so what do you know about anything that your parents are doing at 13? But it was like, that's what we knew. And there was like a cop stationed outside of our house for a while during that period of time. There was not much more discussion beyond that. I wasn't like, so Dad, let's talk about the Swiss bank accounts where Saddam is, the shell company is hiding X, Y, and Z. Or is it like, you know, so you're flying to Kuwait right now? You know, like there just wasn't a ton of discussion around that, you know, and for everyone's sake, you know. But I think it also led me to be someone who's like, I think for the most part, if you tell me something in confidence, like, yeah, nobody else is going to hear about it, you know, because it's like you told me that in confidence.
Did you ever tag along like Veronica Mars and her dad?
No. I would go on a business trip with them every once in a while. I remember, it was like to go to Dallas and, you know, it was not very exciting.
It's every boy's dream to go to Dallas.
Yeah. I was a Cowboys fan, so that was fun. Boy, was I crushed when I found out Fort Worth wasn't Dallas.
When you started like having your own television show and stuff, which is, you know, at this point, 10-ish years ago,
literally almost 10 years ago.
Did you think about what it would mean for you to be a celebrity?
You know, I've had such a...
And Nick, I don't want to suggest that you were like, well, I'm Jennifer Aniston now.
Sure.
I'm going to be... my celebrity narrative is going to be the top one of the world.
Sure. Yeah.
But just that you were not going to be somebody that people like recognized because they saw you at Rafifi in New York.
Right. My trajectory as a comedian and...
They also love the 90s.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's the thing is like, you know, my New Year's resolution, I mean, almost to the day right now, my New Year's resolution going into 2002 was to do an open mic. I got the cojones to get up and do it, I think, at the end of January, beginning of February. So this is like, I did my first open mic about 20 years ago to the day. And then I, within like a year or two, was like on Awesomely Bad 70s songs on VH1. And then I booked commercials. And then I got on, you know, Best Week Ever by 2004, 2005. And then I was, you know, popping up in other things and probably was in my first movie in 2006 or 7 and then was on Cavemen. You know, so it's like it's been such a gradual... My sort of trajectory as a public person has been so incremental and gradual. I had a point when I was like doing Kroll Show and was on The League and was dating someone who was like a public personality where I was like, oh, this is weird. Like, oh, I now understand the other side of this where you're like, oh, this is like this thing that I had been... Because you've interviewed a lot of well-known people, any of them who say like I got into this because I just wanted to do comedy, I didn't want to be famous, they're lying to you a little bit. Maybe 5% of the famous people that you have talked to didn't realize that they were going to be famous. That wasn't part of the goal. I might be weirdly going out on a limb here, but they're lying to you.
But I mean, at the very least, they're aware that fame is the currency they can gain that will allow them to make the things that they want to make.
Yeah, and I believe many of them, by the time you talk to them, don't want to be famous anymore. They got in, they wanted to do, but like part of the motivating factor of being a performer, a musician, an actor, comedian, a writer, a podcaster is for other people to be like, I know you and I like what you do. There are the occasional people who are like, I am a true artist who has no sense of my audience. I just want to create things. And then they become like massively successful. And they're like, boy, I had no idea that this was going to be the end goal of it. But almost to a person, I guarantee somewhere in them wants to be recognized for their work. Then it happens.
Or to affect others.
Yes. And I mean, I'm saying it in the most cynical version of it. But once you get that, you realize there are incredibly tricky elements to all of that, you know? And it's not all fun and games. But it also is. It's wonderful. But it is. I hit a point around then when I was finishing Kroll Show. I was on two shows and it was like, I was like, oh, this is not everything it was cracked up to be. Which then, like, I put everything to bed. I was physically, emotionally exhausted, creatively exhausted, put everything to bed. And me and John started doing Oh Hello to get towards eventually doing the Broadway show. And that's when a big mouth came around and it was animation and it was like, oh, I'm more than happy to not be on camera shooting a show like 9 or 10 months of the year and not have my face on TV much of the time. I definitely was more than happy to take that.
You have a kid who's about a year old.
Mm-hmm.
How has the experience been different than you expected?
I have three siblings. They all have four kids. So I have 12 nieces and nephews. I'm in my 40s. I know so many of my friends. So I've witnessed and been very close to people who have kids. So I was aware of everything that was going to happen for the most part. I think it's that what you can't quite explain or experience until you have your own children is the familiarity, what used to be only internal familiarity, to see that familiarity externalized, where you see another creature, another human being say something or not say, I mean, he's still one. When you see another creature like smile in a way that you've only understood internally before, to see that external is a real trip. Which I guess might be somewhat narcissistic to say, be like, I saw someone else do something just like me, which is not my point. I think it's a different kind of love, truthfully, is like you know it's going to be that you're going to experience a new kind of love. And then you have the child and you're like, yeah, yep. It confirms what I thought, but then I've never felt this way before, which is like you love something So different than like when you choose your partner who you love because you're like, oh, I found my wife, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, whatever. There's something about having a child where it's just like it's like a primordial love that I have not experienced before.
Well, Nick, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It's always great to get to talk to you.
Always a pleasure talking to you, Jesse.
Nick Kroll, folks, his animated show Human Resources just released its second season on Netflix. Go check it out there. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. This afternoon here in Los Angeles, it seems to have finally become summer because it is very hot in my house. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation, thanks to them and to their label Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Follow us in all those places. We share our interviews there. We hope that you will share our interviews with others. Tell somebody about Bullseye. It means a lot to us when you do. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Whether you're planning a weekend away or an international adventure, All Trips Annual Travel Insurance can protect every trip you take for the next 365 days. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.